So tonight is the last of these talks I've been giving over the last several weeks about what I call deconstructing the Satipatthana Sutta. And tonight I want to talk about the fourth foundation of mindfulness, which is often usually called mindfulness of dhammas. And you can look at this whole fourth foundation of mindfulness as ways you can look at what you're experiencing with a certain view, with a certain lens. Each of these dhammas is a way, our ways of seeing and categories all of what we're experiencing, both mental and physical. First thing we're going to do is talk about the word Dhamma, because the Dhamma is one of those things that has so many meanings. And the thing is, it's based on context. And there's capital D Dhamma and little D Dhamma and these sorts of things. But here's three things. That it might be talking about. The Dhamma might mean the truth. Dhamma might mean the law. It might mean the teachings of the Buddha. But within the context of this particular teaching, and really the best translation and from the commentaries that I came across that I liked actually was categories of phenomena. And it sounds a little, ostentatious almost, right? But it's like that each of the five teachings that make up the fourth foundation of mindfulness are ways to sort of take a look at what's happening, but within this particular context. Now, I want to read, I have many things to read here today, so. This is Joseph Goldstein. The Buddha includes in this part of the sutta a comprehensive list of the basic organizing principles of his teachings, the hindrances, the aggregates, the sense spheres, the factors of awakening, and the Four Noble Truths. So these I've talked about all these things many times. In fact, I've given Dharma talks specifically on any one of these. In fact, I've given series. Earlier on this year, I did a series of three talks on just the seven factors of awakening. So, these are like central teachings of the Buddha. So, it's interesting that this is what's here, but it makes sense in the sense that these are themes the Buddha came back to over and over and over again. I want to read a little more of Joseph here. Michael Carruthers, who wrote about the forest monks of Sri Lanka, said that in this foundation of mindfulness, the propositions or of doctrines are transmuted into immediate perception, here and now. It is this transmutation of doctrine that into direct perception that brings the teachings alive for us. Instead of philosophical analysis or discussion, the Buddha is showing us how to investigate these truths, these dhammas for ourselves. This is Joseph speaking. For me, this was a transforming possibility. I had studied philosophy in college, but found it ultimately frustrating because there was no exploration of how to apply the various philosophies to life, to our moment-to-moment experiences. So it's like, oh, this is applied philosophy. I think that's an interesting way to think of it. And we start with something that Anileo said as well here. And this is right. Contemplation of dhammas indicates a temporal progression towards attachment and realization. Although the breakthrough to realization can take place while practicing any of these 16 steps of mindfulness of breathing, the final four steps appear to be specifically designed to this end. Similarly, although realization can take place while one is engaged in any of the Satipatthana contemplations, the final section of the sutta concerned with contemplation of dhammas stands out for its particular emphasis on achieving this goal. In contrast to the previous Satipatthana contemplations of dhammas is particularly concerned with recognizing the conditioned nature of the phenomena under observation. So I've called this before, I've talked with this, looking underneath what we're experiencing to see the patterns underneath it, right? In fact, the main instruction for most of the contemplation of dhammas directly mentions conditionality, while in the previous Satipatthanas, the first three foundations, this happens only in the refrain. The prominence of conditionality in this Satipatthana brings to mind the well-known statement that one who sees the dependent co-arising sees the Dhamma. Such seeing of the Dhamma may well come through contemplating Dhammas, a suggestion that also squares well with the acquisition of the method, which is how it's described in the beginnings of the sutta. Thus, contemplation of dhammas skillfully applies dhammas, little d, classifications of categories, as taught in the Dhamma, big D, the teachings of the Buddha, during contemplation in order to bring about an understanding of the Dhamma, the principles of conditionality, and lead the realization to the highest of all dhammas, nibbana, realization. So he's pointing here to the idea that not only are there's these five teachings that are really well-known teachings of the Buddha, but the reason they're in this particular order, and they are in a very particular order, is that they represent a process of slowly getting to see that everything is conditioned, that everything's impermanent, that everything's unsatisfactory, that everything has no self. So that we can then get to the place where we reach realization. But it's a very sequential process, and it's intentionally sequential. And I'll talk more about that as we go on. But I wanted to sort of make sure that was very clear right at the beginning. So the first of these things is the hindrances, the five hindrances. And here's what that actual sutta says. If sensual desire is present in him, he knows there is sensual desire in me. If sensual desire is not present in her, she knows there is no sensual desire in me. And he knows how unarisen sensual desire can arise, how arisen sensual desire can be removed, and how a future arising of sensual desire can be prevented. Notice what he's saying here. He's saying not just pay attention to what's arising or pay attention to what isn't there anymore, that's gone. So it's not just the arising and passing away, but now we have to contemplate and understand the process of how these things arise, so that we can, in the case of the hindrances, skillfully learn to not get caught in them, to not have them even arise. So it's a different, you know, like in the third foundation of mindfulness, when he's just talking about mental formations, which this is really all is mental formations, he's just saying pay attention to know when they're there and they're not there. But here he's saying, no, pay attention to what's there and not there, but also pay attention, contemplate, how did this happen in the first place? Why is it, what is it that brings about these arisings? What is it about these things that What can I do to work with them when they do arise? What can I do so that in the end they don't arise at all? So it's a different sort of layer of understanding that he's pointing to here. Okay. And then, of course, Joseph has more to say about this. Why does the Buddha begin here with the hindrances? When we're not mindful of them, the hindrances envelop the mind and obstruct it from developing wise discernment regarding skillful and unskillful actions. They hinder the mind's developing concentration and other awakening factors, and they prevent the realization of the Four Noble Truths. In order to proceed on the path, we first need to know how to work skillfully with what impedes our journey. So this is the first one, because this is, oh, we got to figure, get this, least start getting this stuff down. Seeing this, start understanding this. Because until we understand it and learn how to work skillfully with it, we're continually going to just be caught and stuck at this place. Yes, we're seeing things, but then we spin out. We keep spinning out about, oh, it's so unpleasant, or this is but good, or this is bad, or I'm full of doubt, all of the various things that the kilesas bring about. So it's a much more proactive form of practice at this point. And Leo had something else to say here. According to the discourses, if a hindrance is present and one does not recognize it, one is mismeditating. Isn't that an interesting phrase, mismeditating? A form of practice the Buddha does not approve of. But if one does recognize the presence of a hindrance and contemplates it as a satipatthana meditation, one's practice will lead to purification of the mind. In other words, it's either a hindrance because we don't see it and we're caught in it instead, or we see it and now we make it the object of our meditation. Let's just really pay attention to anger and what it feels like, and look at the process of it. This technique of simple recognition constitutes an ingenious way of turning obstacles to meditation into meditation objects. Practiced in this way, bare awareness of a hindrance becomes a middle path between suppression and indulgence, which are the two places we often go, right? Several discourses beautifully illustrate the powerful effect of this simple act of recognition by describing how the tempter Mara, who often acts as the personification of the five hindrances, loses his power as soon as he is recognized. As soon as we see, ah, Mara, I know you. That's a phrase you see in a lot of the suttas. Mara, I know you. I can see you. I know who you are. And then Mara, because Mara works as a deceiver, now we can't. I can't be deceived anymore because I see you so clearly. How can you trick me if I see you so clearly? Mara goes away. That's usually what happens anyway. So, the hindrances come first in this set of the five dhammas because we need to be able to skillfully work with them before we can skillfully work with the other four dhammas. So, we have to have some skill, some practice, some understanding of this before the next ones will be as fruitful. And I'm not saying you have to be perfect. God forbid. I'm not. But we have to start working that so we have, as we come to the other dhammas, we have some connection and still, and don't just get swept away by the kilesas yet again. Analeo has one more thing to say here. This is he's talking with what I was just saying. Overcoming these five hindrances is a matter of crucial importance for all types of meditative practice. For this purpose, the commentaries list a set of factors for overcoming or inhibiting each hindrance. With increasing meditative proficiency, it will become possible to dispel any hindrance as soon as it is recognized, and as quickly as a drop of water evaporates when it lands on a hot frying pan. The centrally important factor for removing a hindrance, whether slowly or quickly, is mindfulness, since without awareness of the presence or arising of a hindrance, little can be done in terms of prevention or removal. This task of mindful recognition is the central theme of the contemplation of the hindrances. So he's making it pretty clear that what we're trying to do is be mindful of these particular things. And you can consciously, at times, especially when you're sort of caught up in a storm of blah, things are all over the place. It's sometimes really skillful to go, if you're dropping little questions into the mind, that question I talk about, like saying, what's going on? Might even be in this case, because you can feel it something doesn't feel right. What hindrances have arisen? You might actually ask yourself that question right in the midst of your, just sitting there paying attention to what's arising. Because just asking that might clue you into them more. Okay. So that's the first of these. Then we come to the five aggregates of clinging, which I know I've talked about many times, but once again, I want to talk about this in the context of what Joseph has to say here. In the next section on mindfulness of dhammas, the Buddha outlines the contemplation of what he calls the five aggregates of clinging. And there is material elements, feeling, vedana, perceptions, formations, consciousness. So there's this one at the beginning, which is all material, sensational things, and everything else is layers of mental process. And Joseph goes on. The Buddha uses this contemplation to analyze our subjective experience, and through this experiential analysis, to deconstruct the deeply held concept of self. So the whole thing we're trying to do here, when we're working with the five aggregates of clinging, is literally learn to see that everything fits into one of those five categories, and there's no self there. There's no separate self at all. We can't find it. We keep looking and we can't find it. Right? There are many instances in the discourses where people would hear these teachings and either become fully enlightened, or if not, ripe for their final awakening with a cloudless, stainless vision of the Dhamma arise in the mind, turning upright what had been overthrown, revealing what was hidden, showing the way to one who was lost, or holding up a lamp in the dark for those with eyes to see. So this is lots of instances of this in the suttas, where the Buddha gives a teaching on the five aggregates, and the person who's listening awakens by just hearing the teachings. They're pretty ripe, obviously. When we bring the teachings of the five aggregates into the realm of direct experience, that lead us into our profound investigation, what we call life. These teachings open up new levels of understanding, similar to and even more transformative than great discoveries of the atom and quantum realities. A little hyperbole here. The teachings on the aggregates directly point to these realities underneath the surface appearance of self or I or being. Through this investigation, we begin to discover what we really are. Notice he says what we really are, not who. I think that's interesting in and of itself. Okay, so this is that's Joseph. Right. So now I want to. I'm still going to shift gears here. I want to actually read some things from the Samyutta Nikaya, because the Samyutta Nikaya, remember, Samyutta means collected, and this is like a collection of all the various teachings the Buddha gave on a particular topic, and the five aggregates of clinging is the by far the biggest section. Compared to all the other sections, it's huge. It's 169 teachings or something like that. And so I thought it'd be really useful if we could just look at what the Samyutta Nikaya has to say. And look at a few of these, because we can sort of see how the Buddha keeps coming back to the same thing from different points of view, because 169 ways of saying the same thing. Got to be some differences. Bhikkhus, form is suffering. What is suffering is non-self. What is non-self should be seen as it really is, with correct wisdom. This is not mine. This I am not. This is not myself. I like this because this is like three different ways of acknowledging not self. This is not mine. I don't own this, this form. But it's also, I am not this. And this is not myself. It's like stating it outright. So this is like, we start to actually see what the Buddha is pointing to. We start to see that this is true, as opposed to it be just a philosophical understanding. We start waking up to the truth of this, right? And then, a little further on, he talks about the five aggregates of clinging as being a burden, something heavy. Because I will teach you the burden, the carrier of the burden, the taking up of the burden, and the laying down of the burden. And what, bhikkhus, is the burden? It should be said, the five aggregates summing to clinging. What five? The form aggregate subject to clinging. The feeling aggregate subject to clinging. The perception aggregate subject to clinging. The volitional formations aggregate subject to clinging. The consciousness aggregate subject to clinging. So he's listening very clearly. Here's the five aggregates. This is what the burden, they burden us. And what, because is the carrier of the burden? It should be said, the person, this venerable one of such a name and clan, this is the carrier of the burden. So by name and clan, he's saying, we have this person who has an identity. You have an identity as being such and such. You know, I'm Joe from this clan, right? And what, because is the taking up of the burden? It is this craving that leads to renewed existence, accompanied by delight and lust, seeking delight here and there. That is craving for sensual pleasures, craving for existence, craving for extermination. This is called the taking up of the burden. And what, because is the laying down of the burden? It is the remainderless fading away and cessation of that same craving, the giving up and relinquishing of it, freedom from it, non-reliance on it. This is called the laying down of the burden. So he's saying, when we so here he is, this is the second noble truth taught a different way. He's saying, if we just stop clinging, then we lay down the burden. Because of what we do, that's why they call it the five aggregates of clinging, because these are the things we cling to. We see things, we think things, we understand things in a certain way, and then we cling to them because that's how we create our self-identity. One more from the Sanyutta Nikaya here. And he's talking about the problem with this teaching, in a sense. And the problem is, like, what do you mean I don't have a self? What do you mean there's no self? It's like, it's because people find that idea frightening. It's like, well, I don't have a self. Who, what am I? Right? Here, because the uninstructed worldling becomes frightened over an unfrightening matter. It might not be, and it might not be for me, and it will not be, and I will not, it will not be for me. But the instructed noble disciple does not become frightened over an unfrightening matter. For this is not frightening to the noble disciple. It might not be, and it might not be for me. So he's saying, it's like, that a noble disciple, someone who understands, someone who gets it, right? The idea of not self is no longer frightening. So, and this is a progressive step, remember, along the process going towards realization. This is what the second of these dhammas, this is what it's aimed at doing. Making us see, not in a, you know, a philosophical sense, but in an actual sense, what's going on. So that's the second foundation. Second Dhamma. We got the first Dhamma, which is like overcoming the things that obstruct us. Then we now start looking at sort of the more subtle hindrances, the more subtle obstructions, in a sense. And the biggest one is that we still have this idea that I'm a separate self. And that's the next thing you have to get past, overcome, understand. And then we get to the six sense spheres. And this is a famous sutta that I'm sure you've all heard me read at least once. Bhikkhus, I will teach you the all. Listen to that. And what, bhikkhus, is the all? The eye and forms, the ear and sounds, the nose and odors, the tongue and tastes, the body and tactile objects, the mind and mental phenomena. This is called the all. If anyone, bhikkhus, should speak thus, having rejected this all, I shall make no one another all, that would be a mere empty boast on his part. If he were questioned, he would not be able to reply, and further, he would meet with vexation. For what reason? Because that would not be within his domain. So this is something we talk about fairly early on when we're talking about mindfulness of body. But now at this point in the sutta, it's like, let's go a little deeper into that understanding. Beyond, this is like the beginning. It says, oh, by the way, everything you're experiencing fits into one of these six. So here's another way of categorizing our experience. Remember, that's what we talked about Dhamma meant. But how does that work, in a sense? And we're going to go back to Anileo here. And he knows the eye, he knows forms, he knows the fetter that arises dependent on both. He also knows how an unarisen fetter can arise, how an arisen fetter can be removed, and how a future arising of the removed fetter can be prevented. So here we are again, but now a fetter is a purely mental, more subtle problem that gets in the way. And what he's saying is, in this particular case, he's saying that these fetters arise directly out of us seeing something and perceiving it, or experiencing something at the level of one of the 6 cent stores. And so we have to see not only what's occurring, but we're trying to be able to see, and how does this fetter me? How does this restrain me? And a fetter is something that restrains you, right? Joseph, of course, has some wise things to say about this. Oops, I just lost my page. He's talking with this idea of fetters. What keeps us then from opening the clenched fists of our minds and falling into the midst of everything? Nice way of describing realization, falling into the midst of everything. The Buddha points the way in the next part of the instructions at the sutta. He says not only to know the sense base and its object, eye and form, ear and sound, etc., but also to know the fetter or defilement that arises dependent on both of them, how it arises, how it can be removed, and how it can be prevented. In our practice, we can watch for the arising of the fetters at any of the 6 sense doors. This is not an academic exercise. What the Buddha is talking about here is the arising and ending of suffering in our lives. Something arises based on our sense door tuning into some object. And then a fetter arises because we want it to go away, we want it to stay, we want more of it. Those are all, that's a fetter, right? If we can recognize only that what the fetter is that arises with sense contact, that is, whether it is a form of greed or wanting, aversion or dislike, or dull not knowing, but also how we feel it energetically, this can help us notice the arising defilements more quickly. Feeling them directly in this way can motivate and inspire us to let them go, because we are actually experiencing the suffering of them. It is like holding on to a hot coal. Once we're aware of the burning sensation, we don't need much prompting to drop it. So he's saying, look at that, all your experiences at the 6 sense doors, and see how everything you're experiencing connects into some form of wanting, aversion, desire, one of the things that gets in the way, right? And we have to sort of be aware of that. And we also have to be aware that this is how we create our sense of a separate self a lot. I like this, I don't like that. Those are both fetters being expressed in broad terms. Right? It's like our sense of self is based on how we see everything arising and how we judge it in a sense. Want this, don't want that, who cares about that one? And the other thing he's saying is that all of the times we're caught not being mindful and not seeing the fetter, every one of these arises directly from sense experience. So all of our sense of self is directly derived from what we sense and our mental constructions around what we're sensing. And so this is what, when we start to see that, this is another way we break down that sense of having a separate self. So this is just, In one sense, and there was a place in the commentary where I forget who it was, whether it was Joseph or Analeo, said, "This is just another way, like the five, the five aggregates of clinging, to look at everything and go, oh, there's no self there. It's just a different approaching it from a different angle, and how we create our sense of self in a different way. These are two different forms of selfing that are predominant. These are also, like I mentioned, that the biggest section in the Samyutta Nikaya is on the five aggregates of clinging. The next biggest section is on the six sense doors. This is what the Buddha talked about more than anything else, these two things, because he kept going back to them to get people to see how they're selfing, how they're creating the sense of self out of what they're experiencing. And how that gets in the way, how that fetters them, how it allows them not to have clear mindfulness. But then in the sutta, now we get the good news. The seven factors of awakening. So once we have a clear sense of our of not self, then the awakening factors kind of rise and start to really cook, essentially. Based on mindfulness being present and clear. Remember, the first of the seven factors of awakening is mindfulness. And now, when we're being mindful, if we aren't constantly being caught up in creating a sense of a separate self, which is a delusion from the Buddhist point of view, then we can actually start to progress along this path called the seven factors of awakening, which is a path within this structure. Right? Here we go again, a structure within the structure, right? And the beauty of this is that the seven factors of awakening lead to equanimity. That's the seventh factor, right? That we go through the seven factors and then we get to this place where the mind is equanimous. And I want to read a little bit of what Joseph has to say here about this. Equanimity, as one of these beautiful universals, is a mental factor called neutrality of mind. Bhikkhu Bodhi said the Pali term could literally be translated as there in the middleness. Although this is an awkward construction in English, it does convey the balancing power of equanimity. Its characteristic is evenness, and when it is highly developed, it manifests as unshakable balance of mind. It serves to prevent either deficiency or excess in the other mental factors. And this idea of what is, how do we know that equanimity is there even, and what does it feel like? The first way we experience the cool, restful quality of equanimity is in the peace and balance it brings to our daily lives. Oh, here we are back in our lives, right? Each of us is touched by what we call the eight worldly vicissitudes. These are the endlessly changing conditions of gain and loss, praise and blame, fame and disrepute, and pleasure and pain. When equanimity is developed, we ride these waves with balance and ease. Without it, we're tossed about by the waves, often crashing into the changing circumstances of our lives. This is a huge long teaching. I've given a long talk on just this idea. It's like, I love the word vicissitudes, by the way, too. I think it's just like it has a certain Victorian quality to it almost, but it's like, and these are the things that all things that we get upset about, right? Gain or loss, praise and blame, fame and disrepute, pleasure and pain. These are the places where we cling. And equanimity, when we're in a state of equanimity, whatever is arising, none of this occurs. It doesn't catch, we just don't get caught by any of this. And I find that it's like, here we are, this is still a mental factor. This is sort of, we're ready to make the leap in a sense. Once equanimity is developed and present, then the final step of realization can start to occur. But equanimity is required, in a sense, for that to happen. And that's what the last things I want to mention here. This is the Four Noble Truths. This is the fifth of the Dhammas. And the wording here is really astonishingly simple, I think. When we get to this particular Dhamma, I mean, all the other ones are talking about knowing when it's there, knowing when it's not there, know how to get it, how to stop it, blah, blah, blah. Then you get to the Four Noble Truths. He knows as it really is, this is dukkha. He knows as it really is, this is the arising of dukkha. He knows as it really is, this is the cessation of dukkha. He knows as it really is, this is the way leading to the cessation of dukkha. Such simple language and such simple instructions compared to the other ones where there's like all these sort of layers of things you have to do. Now you just know it as it really is. That's what we have to do. In the end, when we have overcome the kilesas and the seven factors of awakening are considered the direct antidote to the kilesas. So when the seven factors of awakening are present, the kilesas do not arise. And but we got to that place by having this clear understanding, this clear knowledge of the truth of not self. Then the factors can activate, we reach equanimity, and now we can see, know as it really is, this is dukkha. Know as it really is, this is the arising of dukkha. Know as it really is, this is the cessation of dukkha, right? It's like now we're like hit found this interesting place. And it's so simple in a sense, what he's saying. I mean, simple in its language, not maybe not so simple in actually knowing as it really is. And this is what Anileo has to say about this idea of contemplating the Four Noble Truths. Each of the Four Noble Truths makes its own demand on the practitioner. So he's saying that these Four Noble Truths each have a vibe, what would be our common parlance, right? Dukkha has to be understood. Its origin has to be abandoned. Its cessation has to be realized. The practical path of this realization has to be developed. So this is the actions of the Four Noble Truths. Understand, abandon, realize, and develop. And so if we're actually contemplating the Four Noble Truths, we can contemplate them within that context in a sense. Am I really understanding? Have I really abandoned? Am I really realized? I mean, remember we talked about in the third foundation of mind was we, if the mind is in a state of realization, we can know that and note it, even if it's very temporary. And am I, the fourth, if we're following the Fourth Noble Truth, am I really developing my practice, my understanding? I have to develop something. It's not passive. I can't just look at it and go, isn't that nice? I have to do something. I can't just sit back. Finally, there's this interesting section of the Satipatthana Sutta that people don't talk about a lot, I don't think. And this is a. He's given all the teachings, and then he says, and this is what can happen. If anyone should develop these four satipatthanas in such a way for 7 years, 6 years, 5 years, 4 years, 3 years, 2 years, 1 year, 7 months, 6 months, 5 months, 4 months, 3 months, 2 months, 1 month, half a month, 7 days. These are all time periods, right? Depends on, right? One of two fruits could be expected for him, either final knowledge here and now, or if there is a trace of clinging left, non-returning. So a non-returner is someone who has got to the place where they know that they're not going to have to take another body, and they're not going to return, but they're not fully realized yet. It's sort of a stage along the way. So it was with reference to this that it was said, monks. Now he's basically going to repeat exactly what he said at the very beginning of the sutta. He says exactly the same thing. He said, this is why I said this. Monks, this is the direct path for the purification of beings, for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of dukkha and discontent, for the acquiring of the true method, for the realization of nibbana, namely the four satipatthanas. So right at the end of the sutta, he's saying, he's repeating, this is, and he's saying, you, 1 week of really understanding the Four Noble Truths, I'm really getting to that place and tuning into it. That's all that's necessary. Because it takes a few long times to sort of get to the point where that's possible. But that's a certain point, you reach that clear understanding, and that's the end of the process. You become awakened, and that's in the end is the teachings of the Satipatthana Sutta. It's like everything, it's all very progressive, and even in this, as I just hopefully explained, this section of the Dhammas, which often like I said, I've given talks on one or more of those Dhammas at various times. And that's often how they're taught. And they're not taught in the sense of, oh wait, this is the whole thing and how they all fit together, which is hopefully what I've got across at least somewhat. And that's what I've been trying to do anyway, is just sort of go, oh, see, this is like a whole teaching. And it's laid out in a very progressive form to make us see the process that we're going through. And the last thing I want to say is that we don't want to get caught in the whole idea of, well, that realization stuff, that's for other people. We all have moments of that right now. We all have moments. If we're sincere practitioners, we have little moments of it. And the problem is we may not even notice them. But they're there. There's those moments of pure clarity of mind. And the practice that we're following and working with is just leading us towards more often, for longer periods, having those clear, still, equanimous moments that leads to really seeing the Four Noble Truths as they are. So that's what I have to say tonight.